As I said at the outset of the last episode, we are on what I refer to now as the long road to reform. It's that late medieval era in Europe that sets the stage for the Reformation. We've looked at the degraded condition of the Roman papacy, epitomized by the Great Papal Schism, and the career of the Borgia Pope, Alexander VI. We've looked at the development of sacramentalism and the medieval mystics, who in their own way began a movement of renewal within the Roman Church. We're on the cusp of the Reformation now, but before we dive in, we need to catch up on what's happening to the East. As I said in an earlier episode, accounts of church history, they tend to focus on Europe, largely neglect what's happening to the East, a region with a rich and complex church history. So let's call this episode, Meanwhile, Back in the East. The Mongol Empire of the 13th and 14th centuries occupied the largest contiguous land empire in all of history. Rising originally from the grassy steppe of Central Asia, it eventually stretched from Eastern Europe to the Sea of Japan. From Siberia in the north to Southeast Asia, the Indian subcontinent, the Iranian plateau, and the Middle East. At its greatest extent, it spanned 6,000 miles and covered about 16% of the planet's total land area. The one credited with commencing the Mongol Empire was, of course, Genghis Khan, born to the name Temujin in the Borjinjin tribe of the Mongols. The Borjinjins were at that time shamanists, an animist religion where interaction between the spiritual and natural realms takes place through altered states of consciousness, those brought on by either hallucinogens, extreme physical practices, or both. These altered states of consciousness could be lethal, and so they were left to a special class of priests called shamans, the famous witch doctors of yesterday. Now, considering the explosion of the Mongols onto the world stage in the 13th century, historians have questioned what happened that sparked that emergence. Why suddenly did they burst out of their homeland to conquer so much territory? Well, there's a notable similarity to the emergence of the Arabian tribes in the 7th century under the banner of Islam. Before Muhammad, the Arabians had warred with each other, but he united them under a single cause. And Genghis did much the same with the Mongols. For a long time before he came on the scene, the Chinese recognized the danger their neighbors to the north presented, and that's why they had built the Great Wall. But as centuries passed, they realized that the wall was not enough, so they sent emissaries among those neighbors to foment trouble between the tribes. The idea was to keep them fighting among themselves, so they'd have no strength left to attack the Chinese. Now that policy worked for centuries. By a combination of savvy political maneuvering and outright conquest, Genghis was able to cast a vision among the other Mongol tribes of a future of dominance over others, rather than just incessant fighting among themselves. Well, it worked, and he managed to accomplish his vision. Though the Borjinjins were shamanists, the Karyat, Angud, and Uyghur Mongol tribes had become at least, well, nominally Christian by the Eastern expansion of Christianity that we looked at in earlier episodes. Now, recognizing the need to unite the clans, Genghis Khan adopted a policy of religious toleration that remained the official policy of his reign and that of his son, Ogedai. Now, I want to insert a short parenthetical comment here. Knowing what devastation the Mongols wrought during the 13th and 14th centuries, and the wagon loads of blood that they spilled, we have to be careful when we call these tribes Christian. They certainly weren't evangelical missionaries. Their faith was a highly distorted Nestorian version of the gospel that exercised little restraint on the barbaric rapaciousness that marked their conquests. But still, they called themselves Christians, and their claimed allegiance to the gospel, well, it had a huge impact on what happened in the Middle East. Genghis Khan's grandsons, Hulagu, ruled the Middle East, while Kublai Khan ruled the Yuan dynasty in China. While Hulagu seems to have identified as a Christian, Kublai Khan certainly favored Christians in his court. When Hulagu conquered Baghdad, the Islamic capital of his day, his Christian wife urged him to destroy the city's mosques but protect the churches. Her goal was to dismantle Islam in the region and had it a permanent setback. The Mongols took control of the caliph's palace and gave it to Baghdad's Christian patriarch. It ended up being made into a church, and with such obvious favor being shown Christians, many Mongols converted. Asian Christians who'd suffered under the tyranny and oppression of Islamic rule for generations, they began to look to the advancing Mongol army as deliverers. One writer lauded the genocidal Hulagu and his wife as great luminaries and zealous combatants for the Christian religion. Beleaguered Western crusaders were encouraged by reports of allies in the East doing noble battle with the Muslims. Some crusaders even sent emissaries to try to link up with the Mongols and help them in their conquest of the Egyptian Mamluks in 1260. The Mamluk victory over the Mongols at Ain Jalut was a major disappointment. The Hulagu's son married a Byzantine princess, and he favored Christianity over both Buddhism and Islam. Now, and over the next few decades, the Mongols ceased persecuting Muslims, but did impose what Muslims felt was a heavy burden. They were no longer able to treat Christians living among them as subject people that they could exact heavy tolls and fines from. The Mongol attitude was that as long as everyone paid their taxes, they were free to practice whatever religion they wanted. So a huge source of wealth to the Muslims was lost. Christians across the Middle East took advantage of their newfound freedom and hoped that things would stay that way indefinitely under sympathetic Mongol rule. With Hulagu and his heirs in power, Christians began doing things that had been forbidden under Islam, like carrying the cross in public processions, drinking wine, and building churches where none had been permitted. Then, in 1268 in Baghdad, a tragedy took place that sheds light on why there's such tremendous hatred on the part of certain elements within Islam towards Christians, especially in that region of the world. The Christian archbishop ordered a man to be drowned for converting from Christianity to Islam. Muslims were scandalized and they rioted. Following Mongol policy, the rioting was brutally crushed. Christians took this as further evidence that they were now the favored faith, but that favor was soon to sour. Mongol leaders became increasingly aware that Islam, with its embrace of jihad and the extension of the faith by the power of the sword, well, that was more compatible with their values than either Christianity or Buddhism. So they began to drift towards Islam until 1295, when the new Khan, Mahmud Ghazan, began persecuting Christians and Buddhists. His successors followed those policies. During the early years of the 14th century, Christians found themselves under the control of a Muslim superstate. Their position radically changed from what they had known under the Arab Muslim Caliphate. Rather than simply being heavily taxed, now Christians were subject to intense persecution. In the regional capital of Al-Malak in 1338, all Christians in the city were killed. The few traces of their faith among the Caryats and the Uyghurs didn't last much into the 15th century. The Mongol embrace of Islam proved devastating for the remaining Christians of Central Asia and the Middle East. These communities had managed to weather the storm of the Arab Muslim conquest of the 7th century, and it settled down to an uneasy peace with their new neighbors. But the brief respite brought by the Mongol invasion allowed the Christians to emerge in a dominant role for a time, which they then used to inflict the Muslims with real hurt. When a few years later, Muslims were back in control, this time with the authority of a Mongol Muslim powerhouse, it was payback time. It was the Christians in Egypt who first bore the brunt of this new intolerance. From the start of the 13th century, Egypt was the main target of Western crusades. Frustrated Egyptian governments regularly retaliated for the Crusades by attacking the Copts, the native Egyptian Christian church. In the mid-13th century, Egypt was ruled by the Mamluks, and with the loss of Baghdad to the Mongols, the center of gravity of the Muslim world shifted to Mamluk Egypt. They considered the Christians in their region as a fifth column, in cahoots with the Mongols pressing west towards Egypt. So after the loss of Baghdad, it wasn't hard to imagine a world in which Egypt would stand alone as the last great Muslim power in the Middle East, dominated by Christian Mongols. The greatest Mamluk leader was General Baibar, called the Scourge of both Crusaders and Mongols. Baibar hated Christians in general, but he had an extra dose of loathing for those of the European variety. When he captured Antioch in 1268, he wrote the city's Crusader leader, who'd barely escaped, and he said this, quote, "Had you stayed, you would have seen the crosses in your churches smashed, the pages of your false testament scattered, the patriarch's tombs overturned. You would have seen your Muslim enemy trampling over the places where you celebrated Mass, cutting the throats of monks, priests, and deacons upon your altars, bringing sudden death to the patriarchs and slavery to your royal princes," unquote. this attitude was radically different from the tone of earlier Muslim Christian affairs. It reflected Baibars' fury at the Christian alliance with the Mongols, who themselves were utterly brutal in their conquests. This intolerance was increasingly evident in Egyptian policies toward their still substantial Christian minority. Persecution in Egypt wasn't new, but things deteriorated quickly after the Mamluk-Mongol Wars. Between 1293 and 1354, the Egyptian government launched four campaigns to enforce the submission of Christians and Jews and drive them to accept Islam. Each wave of violence became more intense and better organized. A review of this half-century gives us a much better understanding of the ancient hostilities that have inflamed the Middle East ever since. Now, a quick sketch of what happened. In 1293, an initial persecution fizzled when the Sultan's officials realized the Christians that they were about to execute controlled the country's finances and were the most competent scribes. In 1301, a vizier visiting from Morocco was appalled at the wealth and status of Egyptian Christians and Jews. In Morocco, well, they had to pay a steep fine if they refused to convert and were subject to all kinds of public indignities. But in Egypt, they held high public office, wore rich clothes, and rode the best mounts. This vizier's criticisms moved Egyptian officials to install the same rules as Morocco. A wave of repressive laws followed, and ordinances closed all the churches and synagogues outside of Cairo. Ancient churches were demolished. Precious relics were burned. Non-Muslims were dismissed from public employment and were forced to wear distinctive clothing, blue turbans for Christians, yellow for the Jews. They were forced to ride only on donkeys, no horses. And whenever a Muslim approached, they had to dismount and bow. Visitors to Egypt said that the enforcement of these rules continued all the way into the 19th century. The effects of this crisis linger to the present day. Since the rigorous Muslim legalism that emerged at that time shaped modern Islamic fundamentalist movements. From the 1290s, Muslim jurists produced ever harsher interpretations of the laws governing minorities, particularly through the work of militant puritanical scholars like Ibn Taymiyyah. His life was shaped by the disasters of the Mongol Wars, which forced him into exile in Egypt. Ibn Taymiyyah's goal was the militant restoration of Islam in the face of its enemies at home and abroad. His work has had a long afterlife. He's regarded as the spiritual godfather of the Wahhabi movement and of most modern extremist and jihadist groups. Among many others, Osama bin Laden cited him as a special hero. The Muslim hostility towards Christianity in the early 14th century was reflected in outbreaks of extreme anti-Christian violence. In 1321, Muslim mobs looted and destroyed Cairo's Coptic churches. Muslim clerics gave the signal for attacks by mobilizing crowds in mosques with the cry, "Down with the churches!" The Sultan tried to keep order, but the hatred of Christians was too powerful to contain. They were blamed for setting fires across Cairo. When some of the accused confessed under torture, authorities were forced to support the popular movement. At one point, the Sultan faced a mob of 20,000 calling for the forceful suppression of Christians. In order to safeguard his rule, he permitted a purge. The government went further and announced that anyone who found a Christian was permitted to beat him and take his goods. By the mid-14th century, Muslim writers had a whole catalog of anti-Christian charges that bear a close resemblance to the libellous anti-Jewish tracts known as the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. Christians were accused of being spies, ever on the lookout for opportunities to betray the Muslim state. Cases in both Egypt and Syria proved that they were serial arsonists. Some even reported to having planted a bomb in the Great Mosque of Medina. Given modern-day stereotypes of Islam in the West, it's ironic that Christian minorities were then so feared because they allegedly plotted terror attacks against prestigious symbols of Muslim power. In a society founded on honor and family pride, the humiliations of these new policies were too much to bear for many wealthy Christians who then converted to Islam. Other poorer Christians proved firmer, particularly if they were in rural areas where government policies were slower to penetrate. But later waves of intimidation wore down their resistance. Violence in the 1320s reduced Christian numbers and prepared the way for the disasters of 1354. From the end of the 14th century, Egypt's Coptic Christians were reduced to a tiny minority, and they remain that way in Egypt to this day. The Coptic Church entered a period of hibernation that lasted until the mid-19th century. Sad when we consider that Egypt had been a major center of Christianity for hundreds of years, the home of dozens of vital and prolific monasteries. What was once the 1,000 monks of Bufanda was reduced to just 2. Once their Mongol rulers converted to Islam, conditions became equally difficult for the Christians of Mesopotamia and Syria. Between 1290 and 1330, the story of Christianity in these parts, like that in Egypt, becomes, well, a long list of disasters and ever harsher laws. One edict commanded that churches be demolished and services halted. All clergy and Christian leaders were to be executed. The storied churches of Tabriz, Arbela, Mosul, and Baghdad were torn down. Bishops and priests were tortured and imprisoned. Some laws struck directly at ordinary believers rather than the institutions and hierarchy. Now, some of these edicts came from the Mongol Khans themselves, while others came from local governors. But the effects were just as damaging. Even when the Khans tried to limit persecution, they could hardly stem the zeal of local officers. In some cities, local laws ordered forcible conversion to Islam and prohibited the exercise of Christianity upon pain of death. One Muslim ruler in Armenia passed ruinous taxes and ordered that anyone who refused to convert to Islam should be branded, blinded in one eye, and castrated. Christians and Jews were to be instantly recognizable by wearing distinctive clothing. In the words of one contemporary, quote, "The persecutions and disgrace and markings and ignominy which the Christians suffered at this time, especially in Baghdad, well, words cannot describe," unquote. The persecution reached its height with wholesale massacres at Arbela in 1310 and at Amida in 1317. At Amida, where 12,000 Christians were sold into slavery, the destruction of churches and monasteries was so thorough that the fires burned for a month. These persecutions had a greater effect on the churches of the Middle East than any other event since the conversion of the Roman Empire. The succession of church leadership that had remained unbroken since the time of the apostles came to an abrupt end. Whole Christian communities were annihilated across Central Asia, and surviving communities shrank to just a tiny fraction of their former size. Christianity disappeared in Persia and across southern and central Iraq. The patriarchs of Babylon now literally headed for the hills, taking up residence on the safer soil of northern Mesopotamia.